This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Tim Franks. This time yesterday, I was telling you about a ceasefire deal that had just been announced. A deal to bring a ceasefire to Gaza, a release of Israeli hostages, and an ensuing freeing of Palestinian prisoners and increase in aid deliveries to the Gaza Strip. Today, perhaps this was only to be expected, there appears to have been obstacles, objections, warnings that the ceasefire, due to start on Sunday, could be delayed. And at the same time, continuing violence in Gaza, with dozens killed in Israeli strikes over the last 24 hours. As for the arguments within Israel over the terms of this deal, well, it does still need to be signed off by ministers. And shortly before we came on air, one of them, the far-right security minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, said he would quit the government should the deal go through.
The current deal gives them greater appetite, gives Hamas more motivation. This deal teaches them that they can kidnap and abuse and hurt, and finally, ultimately, get what they want. I think that the release of the hostages should be done in another way. We should stop completely the humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip. Humanitarian only if we get the hostages back.
Itamar Ben-Gvir speaking an hour or so ago. Fleur Hassan Nahum is a special envoy for the Israeli Foreign Ministry. How confident is she that a ceasefire deal will be signed off and it will come into force on Sunday?
Well, it's very difficult to be confident about anything, but ultimately there were a lot of quibbles about the details of the deal. But it was announced this evening that the deal is going through. So let's hope that tomorrow morning it remains in place.
And what do you make of Ben-Gvir's announcement that he's going to quit if this win for Hamas, as far as he sees it, is approved?
Well, the thing is that Netanyahu doesn't need him in order to pass the deal in the cabinet. His coalition is now wide enough. And Ben-Gvir knows that. And so he has to do this for his base, who are, of course, against the deal. And, you know, you can understand why. In normal Western civilization, there was always an ethos that you don't negotiate with terrorists, that that encourages more kidnappings. So you can understand why. And Israel is in a terrible Sophie's choice. We want to get our hostages out, amongst them babies, elderly people, women, young women. And on the other hand, you don't want to encourage Hamas to use this and keep doing this again and again. So you can understand both sides. But ultimately, Israel's main ethos is no man or woman is left behind. And we have to bring our hostages home as soon as possible.
Just to be clear, if this deal does go ahead, one of its provisions is that a lot more aid is allowed in to the starving, battered, impoverished people in Gaza. You're planning to dismantle the main UN relief agency or stop it from operating at the end of this month. Could that be reconsidered?
Well, the problem with the main UN relief agency is A, that it employs terrorists, Hamas. B, it has now been proven that many of its workers actually took part in the slaughter of October 7th. And C...
Many of its workers is a bit of an exaggeration, isn't it? I mean, I think...
No, 12 workers were part, proven to have been part of it. And
out of the many thousands who work for UNRWA in the Gaza Strip.
Yes, but then there were more that were caught with hostages. Two of them were caught with hostages. And when Yahya Sinwar, the head of Hamas, was caught, he was found with a UN badge as well.
Yeah.
And so there's obviously a systemic problem. You can't avoid the fact that there's a systemic problem. But the main problem is the philosophy and the ethos of UNRWA from 1949, which is to reverse the declaration of the State of Israel,
well,
which is against the existence of the State of
Israel. Would completely dispute that. However, the point is there is an immediate issue with getting aid to 2 million people in Gaza.
And there's many wonderful aid organizations that can come in and that are not employing terrorists. The other thing is that the people who are actually preventing the people of Gaza from getting aid are Hamas themselves, who steal the aid and then sell it at a premium to its own people.
Fleur Hassan Nahum, Special Envoy for the Israeli Foreign Ministry. Let's head from Jerusalem to Gaza City, which is where Abir Barakat is a professor of English. Do things feel different today?
It's been mixed feelings, actually. We were very thrilled to hear the news about the sealing the deal, but just knowing that it needs to be implemented after 3 days actually took all the joy from the news. Because right while the press release of the deal was taking place, bombardment was actually taking place at the same time. And then it continued until the morning. It was a bloody night last night. More than 30 people lost their lives. And until now, it continues. And we hear the news of some people whom we know very well who have lost their lives during the 20 hours. So I cannot tell you that we are happy, but we are waiting. We are holding back our joy until Sunday comes.
And then when Sunday comes, even assuming that there is some sort of deal which sees there being quiet for the next 6 weeks, I mean, in a sense, then the work just begins, because presumably, I mean, you are, well, paint the picture for me. What are you living in at the moment, and what sort of access do you have to food and water and all the rest of it?
Well, to answer the first part of your question, actually, when Sunday comes, we will only feel relief that the bloodbath will stop, at least for the coming 6 weeks. At least we know that we would sleep at night feeling safe. At least we won't hear bombardment and feel sorry for the lost lives. That's only how we are going to feel. But in fact, our situation right now is miserable. Right now, I'm staying in some relative's home who have evacuated to the south. When they come back to the north, I need to find another place, maybe to stay in a tent or have a caravan that maybe one of the organizations is going to offer. But when is that going to happen? I have a daily problem and dilemma with securing food, electricity, internet, and water. And I will continue to think about that for the coming days. And not only days, I mean maybe a year to come.
Abir, can I ask how old you are?
I'm 44.
44. So, I mean, you have seen so many terrible rounds of conflict between Israel and just Hamas. I mean, since Hamas has been running the Gaza Strip. And obviously this is by far the bloodiest. Can I ask, I know that you obviously hope that things will be different this time round, but do you have any confidence that things really can change?
I haven't seen many rounds since Hamas took over. I have lived the first intifada, the uprising in the 1980s, and I lived under the Israeli occupation. I know that very well. I remember that very well. The occupation didn't leave Gaza until I was 15. I survived that period. I have survived every attack that Israel has launched in Gaza, and that was not only during Hamas period. It was through all our lives. It's not about Hamas, it's about the occupation.
Abir Barakat speaking to me from Gaza City. Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, is following events in Jerusalem. Let's start on the most recent news. Itamar Ben-Gvir, his news conference, the National Security Minister, in which he threatened to resign from government if the ceasefire deal goes through. What did Jeremy think? Performative or significant?
Bit of both, really, because he's always said that this would be the case. He was very, very critical about it. He said he'd only go back into the government if he pulls out, if Israel resumes the war, cuts off all aid to the Gaza Strip. He said, why would we give gasoline to our enemies? And goes ahead and crushes Hamas entirely. I mean, I think, of course, part of it is performative, because he's also said that they're not going to try and bring down the government. I think he would see that as handing Hamas a bit of a victory. But what he is going to do, he says he doesn't want to be part of the whole thing.
Mm. Just in terms of, I mean, clearly, you know, we haven't got the ceasefire part one yet. How much confidence, if any, is there that we might be able to get from phase one, lasting 6 weeks, to phase two, and a permanent ceasefire, and a full release of hostages, and a full Israeli withdrawal?
Well, it's impossible to say, but, you know, it's pretty... there are many difficulties along the way. So let's say 50-50, perhaps, because, I mean, the thing is that the first stage is about releasing 33 people, women, the elderly, people who are sick and wounded. In a sense, the harder stuff is all in the second phase, and they're going to start negotiating that on the 16th day of the first phase. And the second phase is really all about ending the war. It's all about Israel getting out of the entire Gaza Strip, all the hostages coming out, in return for possibly around 1,000 Palestinians who people like Itamar Ben-Gvir believe are terrorists. So I think to get all that done, it's over a very long period, actually, as well. It's a period of months. So there's an awful lot of time for tensions to rise and things to go wrong. And those people who are highly critical of the machination, the Machiavellian schemes of Benjamin Netanyahu, have even, you know, I've had people suggesting to me that he, you know, he doesn't want this thing to work, and so he will find ways of making sure that it doesn't.
And just, I mean, Jeremy, it's a difficult question to ask anybody at the best of times, but, I mean, you have covered this area, for this region, for so long. There have been so many convulsions, and each time at the end of each spasm, you know, people try and pick shards of hope out of the rubble. Where are you on this one? I mean, do you think that the well has been poisoned for a while yet?
I think that what's happened in the last 15 months is going to have consequences that are going to go on for years and years, will last an entire generation. You know, if you look at a convulsion, probably the only convulsion of similar impact in this long conflict, was in back in 1948, and when Israel declared independence, when the Palestinians had what they call the catastrophe, the Nakba, when they basically their society was destroyed. And then if you think of all the young people, young men particularly, who picked up guns, who were kids then, 20, 25 years later, late 60s, early 70s, was that period when the PLO was very active, when there were a lot of attacks. There was the attack, don't forget, in the Munich Olympics. Mm. And that was the generation that had witnessed all of that happening. And it shaped their lives. And what's happened in Gaza is going to shape the lives of another generation.
Jeremy Byrne, our international editor, speaking to me from Jerusalem. Much more on this story later here on NewsHour. Also on the programme, we're going to hear from the owner of Riette, a domesticated wild boar who's had her bacon saved by the French authorities.
We're going to have a big party. I have a lot of friends and acquaintances who are on tenterhooks waiting for this, and we'll have to celebrate more than once because there's so many of us.
That delightful interview coming up in about 30 minutes or so. Our main headlines this hour, so we've been hearing one of the far-right ministers in Israel's cabinet has threatened to resign if the Gaza ceasefire deal is ratified. And Washington has brought sanctions against the head of the Sudanese army, accusing him of targeting civilians, depriving people of aid, and reneging on peace talks. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC. I'm Tim Franks. The American filmmaker David Lynch has died at the age of 78. He was best known for the surrealist TV series Twin Peaks and films including Mulholland Drive, Blue Velvet and The Elephant Man. The Oscar-winning actor Nicolas Cage starred in David Lynch's 1990 movie Wild at Heart, along with Laura Dern. It's a riotous black drama with generous helpings of violence and sex, and it still unsettles audiences today. Here's a short moment from the film.
Look like a clown in that stupid jacket.
This is a snakeskin jacket. And for me, it's a symbol of my individuality and my belief in personal freedom.
The unmistakable voice of Nicolas Cage there as Sailor in Wild at Heart. And a short while ago, I spoke to the man himself on the line to California.
Well, look, it is a very sad day. I got the news and I was... I know he was contending with a lot. My grandfather had the same situation, so I know it wasn't easy for him. But he was so joyful. He was a lot of fun. I mean, that seems like a trite word, but he made it important to enjoy yourself on the movie set. And, you know, before I worked with David, I was, a very serious kind of method acting 19 on like Birdie, and I thought I had to torture myself. But David said it's not only important for you to have fun, it's necessary. The audience needs this. And he was a true American surrealist. He wasn't like it. He's one of a kind, so he's really going to be missed in the cinema, I think. I remember how inspired he was by Fellini. He loved all things Italian style furniture, music and cinema, and he would invoke Fellini quite a bit, but he always had music playing on the set, and he was so free, he was so loose and relaxed and spontaneous and coming up with ideas on the go. You never knew what you were going to do on a David Lynch movie on that set. It was always full of surprises, and he once told me to sing an opera song about cotton balls. I mean, it just came out of nowhere, and he put it in the movie, but it was that free, you know. He really was a joyous man with a just a hell of a sense of humor, and so fun and funny to work for. And he used to always say, "Solid gold, Nick. That was solid gold, buddy." And
but what's interesting to hear in what you're saying is that he was a man. I mean, he clearly had a very sort of particular vision, a particular tone that he brought to his work. And you might imagine that he would be, he could be this sort of driven monomaniac. But actually, you're suggesting that he came across as a sort of as an easygoing guy.
He was. I mean, he knew how to control his emotions. Like, if he was angry, he knew how to get put in check. You know, like, I remember once, sometimes you can get a song stuck in your head and you can't get it out. And I kept hearing that song, Spinning Wheel. I don't know who did that, Mama's a Pie. I don't know. That's a horrible song. And I said to David, "I'm going to sing it." And he would, "Don't do it, Nixter. Buddy, don't do it. Promise me you're not going to sing that song." And he was serious. And like, I almost wanted to do it just to prank him. And I could tell he was going to get really angry about it because
it could get very dark.
He didn't want it to mess up, stay in his head and mess up his groove. But here's the thing about Lynch. He wasn't just weird for weird's sake in cinema. I mean, it was a true thing with him. It was honest. It was pure. It was a genuine expression. And I don't know. I still don't know really how he did it, but he didn't force it. It just came out of him naturally. And it's like I read your thing in The Guardian in England. It's like, yeah, he made it mainstream. He made surrealism mainstream. I totally concur with that. I used to go see Eraserhead. Hello?
Oh, sorry, Nick. I was just going to say, we haven't got much time left. I was just going to ask whether you think that he is unique, or whether Hollywood could cope with another David Lynch.
Well, I think David is one of a kind, and he is unique. I don't think you can replace him, so that's my answer there. But he's largely instrumental for why I got into filmmaking. I used to see his show, his movie Eraserhead at the New Art in Santa Monica. I grew up watching that when I was in high school. So anyway, yeah, to answer your question, he's one of a kind, and he can't be replaced.
And that was Nicolas Cage, the actor who appeared in Wild at Heart, one of David Lynch's very well-known films, very controversial films, David Lynch, who has died at the age of 78. The British Prime Minister Keir Starmer has warned that unless Ukraine achieves a just peace built from a position of strength, it will embolden not just Russia but aggressors around the world. Speaking on his first visit to Kiev as Prime Minister, he said the history of the 21st century was being written now. And in that spirit, Sir Keir signed what he called a landmark security partnership with Ukraine.
It must be a peace that guarantees your security, your independence, and your right to choose your own future. We will work with you and with all of our allies on steps that would be robust enough to guarantee Ukraine's security, guarantee any possible peace, and deter any future aggression. That conversation will continue in the months ahead.
Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford is in Kiev. It's taken Keir Starmer 6 months to get to the Ukrainian capital. How significant was his visit?
We've seen other British prime ministers over the past 3 years of this full-scale invasion rush to Kiev. Keir Starmer has taken his time. It's been 6 months since he was made prime minister, but he has made it, and he has used this trip here to use pretty strong language, talking about Russia, talking about what he calls its barbaric invasion of Ukraine, and saying that Britain is standing by Ukraine, using that phrase we've heard before, for as long as it takes. But he also, together with Volodymyr Zelensky, signed what they're calling a landmark treaty. It's a 100-year partnership treaty. Pretty symbolic, I suppose, because it shows the message was that Britain is there for the long term, and hoping that one day beyond this war, there will be a relationship, a flourishing relationship in the future. But of course, the focus right now is on how Ukraine can, if not win that war, at least be in the strongest possible position if it is forced to peace talks with Russia at some point in the future.
And I guess Britain there in the long term comes against the backdrop of people wondering whether the US is going to be there in the short term.
Yeah, it's all about Donald Trump, frankly. This is a big waiting game to see whether the US under Donald Trump will completely change its policy on Ukraine, or whether it will actually continue pretty much as things have been until now. It is the vital player in terms of supporting Ukraine, and Volodymyr Zelensky has said that again today. So, yeah, big questions about what will happen to US aid and military support for Ukraine, and whether or not Ukraine will be forced into talks. All this talk at the moment is about strengthening Ukraine for that moment. I think, you know, for the first time that I remember, probably in 6 months or so, it is all about looking towards that possible moment, whenever it may come. But at the same time, of course, still battling in the east of Ukraine, and a drone overhead, a Russian drone over the palace here in Kiev, as those talks were taking place and the air defence guns went to work to shoot it out of the sky. So a reminder of the reality, the everyday reality of this war here for Ukrainians.
Sarah Rainsford, our Eastern Europe correspondent, speaking to me from Kiev. This is NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. One of the stories early in the new Trump administration is likely to be the threat of tariffs on countries which export to the US. China, Mexico and Canada are three of the prime targets. What about countries in Africa? Michael Koloki has this report from Kenya.
It's quite busy out here on the streets of the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. I'm standing in a neighborhood of the city known to host a number of diplomatic missions. As I look into the distance, I can see a large, imposing building. And that is the U.S. Embassy. Kenya and many other African countries have had a long-standing relationship with the United States. As Donald Trump prepares to take office, what would his presidency mean for Africa-U.S. trade relations? During Donald Trump's campaign in the lead-up to the 2024 U.S. elections, he constantly emphasized his America First policy, which some economists have implied to mean that he will focus on building America as his priority. What do regular business people on the continent feel about Trump's possible impact on business in Africa?
My name is John Mwangi Wahome. I'm a small-scale trader.
Now, I see that you are here selling clothes.
Yeah.
Are any of your clothes imported?
Yeah, I usually sell second-hand clothes, so we rely on importation.
Would some of that be from the United States?
Yeah, mostly UK and US, we usually target that market.
So do you think Trump's presidency might have a direct impact on your business itself, because you're importing items directly from the United States?
Yes, I think so, because it will affect the taxation, those things, and it will still go back to us as traders.
Okay, my name is Wambui Masharia.
Just to ask you, I see you're a business person here in Nairobi. Do you import or export anything to the United States?
Some of the products, I get them from there.
So for you, the United States is an important market for you as a business person?
Yes, really, it's a very important place for me.
As Trump is sworn in as president in a few days, what are your hopes as a business person here who imports from the United States?
I only hope for the best. At least he makes things easier for us.
The Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, commonly referred to as AGOA, is a preferential trade program that allows eligible countries in sub-Saharan Africa to export certain products to the United States tariff-free. AGOA is set to expire in 2025. Will Trump's administration renew AGOA or decide to do away with it? Grace Asante is an economics professor at the Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology in Kumasi, Ghana.
Whether he likes it or not, Africa is a key in their development. But I don't think that he will just end the program, because whatever it is, they are also benefiting from it. It's not a matter of only Africa benefiting. And if he does so, you know, the other countries are also trying to get hooked to Africa. If you study the background of their relation with China, it's because China has been so aggressive in Africa, trying to get more countries on his side.
So as Trump prepares to take office, it remains to be seen exactly what his trade policy will be towards countries on the African continent.
Michael Kaloki reporting from Kenya. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. I'm Tim Franks. It has taken many, many months of back-and-forth diplomacy, back-and-forth negotiations, and untold amounts of anguish just for Israel and Hamas even to get to this precarious point. The prospect of a ceasefire on Sunday and the immediate chance of 6 weeks of some respite on all sides, during which time a further sequencing of hostage release, Israeli troop pullback, aid influx and Palestinian prison releases should take place. And then, and it is a very big hypothetical, there could be the start of a longer-term discussion about reconstruction and a more stable future out of this century-old conflict. Nonetheless, when it does come to a vote, the best guess is that the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will get the backing he needs, at least for the first phase of this ceasefire deal lasting 6 weeks. Frank Lowenstein was a US special envoy for Middle East peace in the Obama administration. What level of confidence does he have in the ceasefire coming into force and lasting for any length of time?
Those are two important questions. I think the deal will get approved by the Israeli cabinet. That'll happen tomorrow or the next day. It's really not surprising that there's some last-minute wrangling over the details and some political maneuvering by Prime Minister Netanyahu. This is sort of standard operating procedure for the Israelis. And the extreme right parties in his coalition don't have the ability to prevent the deal going through. Their real leverage is to threaten to pull out of the government. And that's what Netanyahu is dealing with right now. So the real question is not whether the deal goes through so much as what kind of promises does Netanyahu have to make the far right to keep them in the government, and what's going to be the impact that has on the ceasefire going forward.
And then assuming it does last 6 weeks, and then the sort of, you know, 2 weeks into that 6 weeks, the next round of negotiations begin on the full hostage release and the full Israeli pullout and the release of more and presumably higher value Palestinian prisoners.
Right.
When it comes to that, Donald Trump will be the president. How much leverage do you think he is likely to exert on the Prime Minister, given that he has said that he doesn't particularly want his administration to be facing a Middle East that is at war?
Right. Well, I think President Trump's primary motivation has always been to sort of advance the greater glory of Trump. And I think his grandest aspirations for the region are normalization of relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel. And I think he hopes he might get a Nobel Peace Prize or something out of that. But that might cause him to put more pressure on the Israelis to move from phase one to phase two, because without a permanent end to the war, there's really no way the normalization process can advance. That being said, his national security advisor incoming just said, you know, we support Israel. Israel resuming the war if they don't, you know, get everything they need in the next 6 months and a clear understandings about how it's all going to work going forward. So I think there's been a clear message sent by the Trump administration that they're prepared to allow Israel to resume the war at the end of 6 weeks if the Israelis want to.
In which case, I mean, that is sort of... It's going to be limited respite all round, isn't it, really? I mean, if we're going to be back at the point where this, it is already 50 months in, feels like a bit like a forever war, continues, but you're suggesting that, you know, that is the probability.
Yeah, it does seem that way right now. I think Netanyahu may have had to promise his right-wing coalition members that he would resume the war. So I think the best way to look at this is a six-week ceasefire, get hostages out, which is obviously a high priority, and also get humanitarian assistance to the 2.2 million Palestinians living in absolute horrible conditions in Gaza right now. And so they're promising 600 aid trucks going in. So I think there's a lot of positives that can come out of it. But in order for this to be an end of the war, like we saw with the Lebanon agreement, there's going to have to be agreements reached on post-war governance and the sort of things that the Israelis have really been unwilling to engage on in any serious way.
Can I ask you to give me a thought about where you think all this has left the United States? Because you will be aware, and you may say that it's unfair, but presumably you are aware that the United States standing in the world because of its full-throated support for Israel over the last 15 months, obviously the supply of a huge amount of military aid, has damaged the US standing in the world in many people's, many governments' eyes. Do you see that possibly being repaired anytime soon?
Well, I think you're quite right. It's hard to argue anything other than that. Just look at the votes at the United Nations. We're consistently the one party standing up for Israel and all of this. And it has cost us in terms of our image around the world and the way people perceive the United States. Do we really stand for democracy, human rights, and the rule of law, which has always been what the United States was supposed to be, you know, the leader of? And now we really compromised ourselves in terms of that image we have around the world. Whether Trump is going to change that or not, I think is sort of an open question. Again, I think there's some personal incentives he might have that would align us with a policy of, you know, keeping the Israelis from resuming this war that would be help us to resume, you know, our rightful standing in the world. But it that all remains to be seen.
And just in terms of the possibility that this then leaks into an even more permissive approach from the Americans towards what Israel is doing in the West Bank, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I think that's probably very, very likely. I think that President Trump's goals with respect to, you know, his broader regional designs may be contingent upon a sustainable ceasefire in Gaza. But I think that probably the Israeli right is thinking, okay, even if we have to end the war there, we'll annex big parts of the West Bank, we'll destroy the Palestinian Authority, and we'll basically take over. You know, and that's been their long-term vision of creating this sort of greater Israel. So yeah, I would expect to be Trump to be very permissive on that front, as he was during his first term.
Frank Lowenstein, U.S. Special Envoy for Middle East Peace in the Obama administration. So where, longer term, could this leave the Palestinians? Noor Oder is an independent journalist and political analyst based in the occupied West Bank. We'll get on to the prospects in a moment. First, though, what does she make of the fact that a ceasefire deal has at last been struck?
This is a day I think everybody with a conscience has been waiting for since day one of the war. And one shares the joy and the mixed feelings of mourning and fear that people in Gaza are feeling. The first thing I did following confirmation and announcement was to call up my friends and loved ones in Gaza. And it was a mix of emotions because, first of all, it takes effect on Sunday, so everybody knew that there was a lot more tears to be shed between the announcement and Sunday, and because everybody understands that there are a lot of nuances and a lot of ways in which this deal can go south.
What do you make of the role of Donald Trump in all this? Because, I mean, clearly during the first Trump administration, I think most Palestinians would have regarded him as being, you know, not a particular friend of most Palestinian aspirations. But, you know, a lot of people are saying that him saying there needs to be a deal done by the time I reach office on the 20th of January did concentrate minds. Do you think that there is a certain amount of credit that is due to Mr. Trump?
Look, I think Trump's tactics are effective because he is a bully. And he bullied his way into getting that this agreement so that he can have the show he wants on Inauguration Day. But in exchange for that, Israeli media is reporting that he already promised a whole bag of gifts for Netanyahu, including immediately lifting the sanctions on Israeli settlers involved in attacks against Palestinians that were imposed by the Biden administration, along with many other political goodies, if you will. So this wasn't all bullying, and it wasn't a change of heart or a dramatic change of policy. And the fine print of what Trump wants is not very different from what Netanyahu wants in terms of end goal in Gaza and what could happen. So the news very welcomed by Palestinians, but I don't think that there are any illusions as to where Trump stands in terms of Palestinian rights.
And what's your view, Noor, of where this leaves Hamas, where this deal leaves Hamas? Because, I mean, clearly Hamas has been pummeled over the last 15 months. And obviously, and, you know, we've been getting reports of this, there is opposition, some opposition within Gaza to Hamas, because people feel, look, you have brought hell down on our heads by predictably what happened in the wake of October the 7th. Against that, though, there are some people who say, look, their standing will be improved, will be boosted by the release of lots of Palestinian prisoners. Where do you see the balance being for Hamas?
Well, look, I think, first of all, it was wrong from get-go to paint a one-dimensional picture of Hamas and of Gaza to begin with. Hamas was not ruling Gaza because everybody there was a member of the organization. But at the same time, Hamas is a large organization that is very much present, not just in Gaza, but in Palestinian political life. And it's not just a military organization. It has a very powerful military wing that has, as you said, been pummeled. But it's also a social movement. It has a student movement. It is active in every aspect of life in Palestinian political circles and social circles. So those who support Hamas ideologically will continue to do so. Those who opposed Hamas before October 7 will continue to do so. And I don't think it's realistic to look at what happened in Gaza and say the logical outcome would be that Palestinians will say, we don't want Hamas anymore. This is not a foreign organization. But what is very true is that Palestinians need to step up and have a conversation among themselves and reimagine their politics, because right now they are fractured. And without them putting on the table what their united vision for how Palestine should be governed, the West Bank and Gaza together, then it will be decided for them by regional and international players. And that has never worked out to the benefit of Palestinians. And so really the fear amongst many Palestinians is that we are back to square one in the Palestinian context, where you will have a lot of throwing blame around, where you will have the Palestinian Authority and Hamas competing to have a bigger sway in Gaza, but without really resolving that elephant in the room of a fractured Palestinian polity. Trump is coming into office, Netanyahu is still in power. All of these things should be moving them in the direction of unity. I want to be hopeful, but I am skeptical, unfortunately.
And that was the Palestinian political analyst, Noor Adair. You're listening to NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC with me, Tim Franks. Good news and slightly disappointing news for one of the world's richest men today in his very large rocket. The very large rocket was called New Glenn Rocket. It launched today from Cape Canaveral. It's funded by Jeff Bezos, part of his Blue Origin project, and it did reach orbit for the first time, tick, but then it failed subsequently to descend to a landing platform several hundred kilometres away in the Atlantic Ocean. Joey Roulette is the Business of Space reporter for the Reuters news agency. How important was this launch?
This was a pretty important launch for Blue Origin. It was their first time going to orbit, which is pretty spectacular considering they were founded about 25 years ago. And right now they're trying to break into the satellite launch business and compete with Elon Musk's SpaceX. So that they were able to reach orbit on the first launch of their main rocket, New Glenn, which is to compete with SpaceX, is a pretty spectacular moment for the company. But as you said, of course, it had that other ending where the booster didn't make it back as planned. But yeah, it's a big moment for Bezos of Blue.
Well, it is a big moment. I wonder sort of whether they can catch up, though. I mean, given that I was reading, I think SpaceX launched 100 times last year. And as you said, this is the first launch in two decades. I mean, obviously, it's a big step to get over. But now, what do you think?
Yeah, well, what's interesting is that Blue Origin with New Glenn already has dozens of customer launch contracts signed and lined up for this New Glenn rocket. And so they're going to be very busy in the coming years. And SpaceX, yes, has launched over 100 times this past year. And a lot of those launches were in-house Starlink missions. They were deploying their own satellites to expand their Starlink network. And what's interesting about New Glenn's role is not just that it's going to compete with SpaceX's Falcon 9 to launch customer satellites, but it's also relied heavily on by Amazon's Kuiper satellite internet network, which will compete with SpaceX's Starlink. And so if New Glenn can get into this routine launch pace, kind of like the Falcon 9 does, it's going to, you know, create competition not just for SpaceX's launch business, but also kind of pave the way for rising competition to SpaceX's Starlink as well.
Right. And presumably competition is good both in terms of developing new technology and bringing prices down.
I think NASA and a lot of US officials would agree with that, yes.
Yeah. And just in terms of where Bezos and Blue Origin can go next, am I right in saying that although they have been slow starters, they could actually beat Elon Musk to the moon?
I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty with the U.S. moon program right now, you know, whether how many companies are going to be involved and whether the incoming Trump administration is going to completely change course and go to Mars instead, which is, you know, funny enough, what Elon Musk wants. Mm. But I talked to Jeff Bezos this past week about that, and he said he's not worried about, you know, incoming changes, and he's not really worried about Musk's influence over Trump and how that might change the space agenda.
Joey Roulette, Business of Space reporter for Reuters. Animal rights campaigners in France are celebrating after a tame boar was saved from the chop. The animal, named Riette, after a coarse meat pâté, was raised by a woman called Elodie Capet after she'd found it abandoned in her garden. She told me, by the way, the name was just meant ironically. Anyway, the authorities had refused her permission to keep the animal, and it faced either being farmed out to someone who trained animals for films or being killed. On the line to her farm in central France, Elodie told me when she found out that Riette was spared.
Well, I found out this morning when my lawyer called me at 8, and he pranked me, telling me he was in a bad mood and that the day had got off to a bad start. So I thought we'd lost, and then he burst into laughter and he said, "We won."
Can you explain to me why Riette was under threat?
She was under threat because you have to know that under French law, as soon as a wild animal seeks refuge with humans, we're considered as criminals, as if we'd grabbed the animal from the wild. So Riette was threatened with euthanasia or being taken away from us.
So how long have you had Riette?
Riette came to us on the 1st of April 2023, April Fool's Day. I came into the house holding her in my arms, but my husband couldn't see me as he was in the bathroom, so I called out to him, "I found a wild boar piglet," and my husband thought it was an April's Fool, but not at all.
It wasn't a joke, though, was it? And, I mean, do you know how Riette ended up on your property?
Well, in April, it's not hunting season, so I don't know. Maybe she was scared by a jogger or dog. Or maybe it's because she's so different from others of her kind and her mum may have abandoned her because of that.
So in what way is she different?
Because she's super intelligent. She was very close to us from the start. She's very bright. She very quickly learned everything we taught her. She can sit, lie down, beg. She really is very advanced.
Tell me, Madame Capet, when did you hear that there was a threat against Riette?
Well, people thought I'd been denounced by someone in the village, but not at all. Actually, I declared the fact that I had her to the authorities when I got her, so we were under threat from the moment I told them.
So she has been under threat for a few months. So were the authorities saying you need to release her back into the wild?
Not at all. The authorities wanted to have her euthanized from the start, or to find a place which was willing to take her in. And nobody wanted to because she's so big. So the only place they found was with a trainer who trains animals for film work, for commercial purposes, which was out of the question.
So how did you manage to win? This became a very big issue in France, from what I was reading.
In France and everywhere in the world, I had calls from the US, from Ukraine, Brazil, Canada, Belgium. That story really spread around the world. And I have a great lawyer who's very good, and we found some legal precedent. I managed to get in contact with other people. There are about 70 cases in France of people who legally own wild boars.
There was peril for Riette, but there was also danger for you as well, wasn't there? I mean, you faced some quite severe punishments.
Yes, of course. They mentioned up to 3 years in jail and a fine of €150,000.
That's extraordinary. Okay, so listen, good news today. you can keep Riette. How are you going to celebrate?
We're going to have a big party. I have a lot of friends and acquaintances who are on tenterhooks waiting for this, and already this evening we plan to party. We'll have to celebrate more than once because there's so many of us. But people are very happy. Friends, family, supporters, my lawyer, all our backers are delighted. You know, people have been crying with emotion here in France at the news.
Amazing stuff. Elodie Capet, the woman who has saved Riette twice over, it seems now. That's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for your company.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light
and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.